people in general, they see this name, this writer, and like everyone just like either they start genuflecting or they fall apart. And my thinking is a thought experiment is to approach this conversation the way we approach any and all conversations, which is the story itself. This one is as hard to do as any we've ever done if we are keeping to that idea. So everybody who talks about this story, it was published in Kafka's lifetime. It was a story he was very proud of. But I don't want to get into all that. I mean, I'm happy to, but like, what is this? I guess that's my question.
This is The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. First published in 1913, The Judgment is a story by Franz Kafka. Among critics, it's considered something of a breakthrough story for him, and one Kafka himself was proud of, having written it in the span of one day. The judgment of the title is a pronouncement made by the father of the main character, George Bendeman. It's likely that this story, The Judgment, is one of the most analyzed of Kafka's stories. It's often described as being chaotic and full of paradoxes. Here now, Peter Orner and I discuss The Judgment by Franz Kafka.
What were your impressions? Like, what is this? And maybe if we, I'm sure we have listeners that are familiar with it, and I'm sure we have listeners who aren't familiar with it. How do you approach talking about The Judgment?
You know what I'm thinking about? And it comes from listening again to the Edna O'Brien podcast episodes that we did, where you're asking, why is this story important? It's not about, do we like it? Do we genuflect? Do we fall apart? Do we not like it? Do we read into it because of his biography? No, we take the story just as the story and ask the question, why is this an important story?
But I mean, I want to take back if I ever said that, because that almost kind of goes in like, you know, like, it's important. I should read this, right? I take back anything I ever said, because Edna O'Brien was a genius and she didn't need me or anybody else to tell anybody that her story was important. I don't think I'm just going to say it. Judgment's not important. Yeah, none of the stories we have talked about are important, even though I'm sure we've both said they're important. It's kind of like, I think the spirit of this podcast has always been above and beyond, or even to the side of that, because that sounds almost academic to me. It sounds like, oh, you have to read this story to understand Kafka's trajectory, which is what everyone would say. Mm-hmm. All the biographers say that this is the one. This was the, including Kafka himself, that this was the story that kind of sent him to another place and allowed him to free his imagination to create all the other stories that he made after The Judgment. That's the basic line on this story. So I suppose it's important for that reason, I guess. But like, let's get into it. Like, I mean, see, we're doing it. We're already 10 minutes into the podcast. We haven't talked about the story at all. So tell us about this story, Yvette.
So the story, the first part of the story has to do with George writing a letter to his friend who is in Russia. And in this letter, we really learn a lot about George, the main character. So there's all this. What?
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. Okay, go ahead. I'm coming into this podcast ready to pounce on everything, including everything I say. I'm in a crouching position of pouncing.
Well, unfortunately, I'm sort of in that academic stance of.
Well, I sort of suspected, but I think here, I think it's especially susceptible as a trap. But I'm going to do something I've never done, I don't think, on this podcast. And I feel a little bit like when, and I don't know why I watched this, but in the Republican convention, that so Don Jr. gets up there. I can almost imitate his sort of way of raising his he's doing something with his back, and his chin's kind of going in because he's ready to tell like a great joke. It's such a putz. And the joke was, I'm going to do something that Trump has never done before. And that is, I'm going to give up the microphone. And then his daughter comes out and gives a nice, cute speech about how, you know, how doting Grandpa Trump is, which is, you know, a little bit hard to believe. But anyway, my point is, I was doing that myself. Like, I'm going to do something on this podcast I've never done before, as if anybody would care. But I don't think I've ever talked about a TV show. on this podcast before, but I would say a way into the judgment is curb your enthusiasm. And why is that? Because the story is about, at least initially, about a guy who is reticent to tell a friend about his good fortunes. Why? Because his friend's a loser, right? In his mind, his friend's unhappy. So like, do I invite the friend to the wedding? Is it gonna seem like I'm dissing him? Do I invite my friend to the wedding? My friend is not a success. Should I invite him? And you could see Larry going around and talking to all his friends. Should he invite his friends? Is that crazy, to that analogy? The story is hilarious in that sense, because this story, we have all been there. And, you know, like, oh, you know, you have a good moment in your life, and then immediately you got to have another angle on it. And the angle is, oh, no, now I'm showing off to my friend who is actually not as successful as me, and therefore I'm in a conundrum. And it's almost this way of showing off even more in your own mind. So, like, we don't know anything about the friend. The friend, and, you know, we're going to talk about whether or not the friend is even a friend, is even existing, which is the kicker in the story. We have a guy, his name's George. He's a businessman. He works with his dad. His wife is, his mother has passed away. And he is engaged to this rich woman. He keeps describing her as wealthy. The question of the story is whether or not he's going to tell his friend about the fact that he's getting married and or invite him. That's the story, what it's about initially anyway. Is that, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that says it.
Okay, so but what were you going to say, like, in terms of, like, setting the story up? How would you have done it? I mean, I assume you haven't read the story in a while, right?
Had not read it in a long while.
What did you make of it? Were you bored by the story?
Yes and no. So
that's because I think that, like, just be honest. I mean, like, maybe you didn't like it. That's fine. There is no law that says you have to like the story. You know, this is a comedy, and all this stuff are comedies. And if you think they're not, you're crazy. They're comedies with suicide in them.
Just to answer your question, I can't help it. I just know all the stuff about how he wrote it in one day. He thought it was, like, his best thing, and people think it's his best thing, and people talk about the paradoxes. And so that part of it, for me, this reading, knowing all that and carrying that into the story and saying, okay.
So people talk about the paradox, yeah. whatever.
Yes, right? All that okay. stuff. But okay. What I was thinking about this reading is I was really focused on the father, and I know the whole bit about Kafka's father. There was just something about the character of the father in this one being so irrational, talking out of both sides of his mouth, that was really sort of coming to me in my reader response in 2024 in a very different way.
Well, I think we got to segue into that part of the story. You got a guy he's alone on a Sunday morning. He's writing a letter to his friend. And in his mind, this machinations are, should I write him? Should I tell him? Should I not? But basically, he's decided that he is going to tell the friend, and he is going to invite him to the wedding because his fiance wants him to do that, because she wants to know everything about him, and she doesn't want anything kind of, you know, if he's your friend, you should invite your friend. I want to meet all your friends, he says. And then they're kissing, actually, in his memory. He's thinking about this at his desk. She's not there. And she says, yes, but might he not hear about our getting married through some other channel? Because he's saying, like, he's not going to tell. I can't prevent that, of course, but it's unlikely in view of the kind of life he leads. George, if you have friends like that, you shouldn't have got engaged at all. I mean, this is pure, like, this is ridiculous. I know we're both to blame there, but I wouldn't have it any different even now. And when? And this gets, you know, Kafka doesn't get that sexy. And he does in his letters and his journal and, you know, his diary, but not so much in the stories to my memory. But I wasn't going to do that. I wasn't going to talk about Kafka's oeuvre. And when panting between his kisses, she went on to say, no, I'm hurt. I really am. There did indeed seem no harm at all in writing to tell his friend everything. That's the way I am. and that's the way he must accept me, he said to himself. I can't carve another person out of myself who might be better suited for friendship with him than I am. So he's going to tell him. He's gonna let him know, and he's writing this letter. At the end of the letter, he says, he saves it for last. He says, I've kept the best news till last. I've become engaged to Miss Frieda Berdenfeld, the daughter of a wealthy family who came here long after you left. You're hardly likely to know them. There will be other opportunities to tell you more about my fiance. Let me just say now that I'm very happy, and that the only change this has made in our relationship is that instead of having a perfectly ordinary friend in me, you will have a happy friend. You will also have in that person of my fiance who sends you her best wishes and who will be writing to you herself very shortly, a sincere friend of the opposite sex, which for a bachelor is not without importance. I know how many things stand in the way of your paying us a visit from Russia, because that's where he's been living all these years while being unsuccessful. But wouldn't my wedding provide just the occasion to sweep all obstacles aside for once? Well, be that as it may, make no allowances, but do only as you think fit. So that's the kicker. It's the end of the letter. He's decided, yes, he's going to invite the friend. So to go back to my Curb Your Enthusiasm analogy, you can see like Larry reading this letter and, you know, his friend's office, his agent friend. And then, you know, the agent say, yeah, no, send it. Yeah, invite him. Send it. So in this story, instead of talking to his best agent friend, George, in this story, walks across the hall to talk to his father, who he lives with. And they share an apartment together after his mother's death. And this is when the story shifts into the father and his conversation, which begins with him saying, you remember my friend who went to Russia? You know that guy. He used to tell those great stories, among which one of the things that happened in this reading of the story was a memory that he says about his friend telling stories about Russia and the revolution when he comes back for visits. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. I think, like, it is not wrong to feel like this story is there's something dull about it. I can feel that. And I almost think it's conscious of Kafka. I mean, you think it's not a joke. And you can't ever really figure out, you never sort of settle. That's what it's like. You never sort of settle on whether you think it's a joke or not. I think that's the weird beauty of it. And I'm not sure why that is and why that works. And, you know, why he's so, like, quote unquote, important. I mean, I just, again, I think that's ridiculous. I just think, like, he's unsettling.
When I took a step back from it and I thought, okay, this is a story in two parts. The first part is this letter where George is sort of controlling everything, including his friend's impressions or the impressions he assumes his friend will have, including that we have to be privy to the panting and the kissing with the fiance. Like, I feel like George is so in control in that part. Then when he goes across the way to his father's space, and it's a space that he hasn't been to in a very long time, apparently. It says he had not set foot for months in that room. And then George has zero control of the situation. I would say the father is in a kind of a control, but it's a chaos that the father's creating.
I think that's great, but I think like the whole story is George. And then, yes, the father is the only other person in the story, mm-hmm. other than the maid, who's a character I hadn't noticed, but actually is interestingly appears at the end. And I think she doesn't actually talk, but she's there. And if you, yeah, go ahead.
No, that's it. And that's not a terribly original take on the story. I think people talk about the chaos of that second part of the story.
Well, get back to the, well, why is it crazy? Like, what? So he goes in the room and he says, George, his father said, coming across the room towards him, his heavy dressing gown fell open as he walked. The flaps and the descriptions of the father and his dressing gown are wonderful. His heavy dressing gown fell open as he walked, the flaps swirling about him. He's still a giant, my father, George said to himself. Then he said, it's intolerably dark in here. It's dark, all right, his father replied. And you have the window shut? I prefer it that way. It's really warm outside, said George, as if following up his earlier remark. He took a seat. His father cleaved the breakfast things away and put them on top of the cupboard. I just wanted to tell you, George went on, following the old man's movements with a forlorn look, that I've sent word of my engagement to Petersburg after all. He pulled out the letter of his pocket a little way, but then let it drop back. Why to Petersburg? His father asked. To my friend, you know, said George, looking his father in the eye. He's not at all like this in the office, he was thinking, sitting there so foursquare with his arms across his chest. Quite your friend, his father said with emphasis. But I told you, father, how I didn't want to tell him of my engagement at first, purely out of consideration for no other reason. You know yourself how difficult he is. What I said to myself was he may hear about my engagement from someone else, though that's hardly likely in view of the solitary life he leads. I can't help that, but he's not going to hear about it from me. And now you've changed your mind, is that it? His father inquired, putting his huge newspaper down on the windowsill, placing his spectacles on top of it and covering the spectacles with his hand. Yes, now I've changed my mind. If he's a good friend of mine, I said to myself, then my being happily engaged will make him happy too. That's why I no longer had any hesitation in notifying him of the fact. But before I posted the letter, I wanted to tell you what I've done. Okay, you know, the story, the two parts of the story have merged because he was indifferent or indecisive about whether or not he was going to. This is ridiculous, but we've all been through this. Should we invite someone to our happy event, or will that make that person feel bad? Because now, well, I've always been better than that person. But I mean, now it's going to be like hit home, right? Look at my beautiful wife, my beautiful house. And now he decided, no, he's my friend. Haven't you been through this? Like, if they're my friend, they're going to be happy for me. I'm going to mail this letter. But for some reason, he has to run it by his dad first. This is weird.
I like the detail about the letting the letter out of his pocket a little way, then letting it drop back.
Like, absolutely gorgeous. Absolutely. Yeah. Just, you know, and I think we don't think about Kafka's, his eye, how good it is, but it's exceptional. No, but I mean, so now you're talking about the chaos of this scene, but I mean, it starts out it's fairly normally. Remember my friend? Yeah, I mean, your friend, right? Your friend in Petersburg, right? And now you've decided, you know, because we've been talking, because apparently apparently all George talks about is the friend from Petersburg. And so here he is again. He talks about it with the fiance. He talks about it with his father. And there's this wonderful detail, which I cannot find at the moment, but where his father used to not like his friend very much. But then he recalls that his father did like to hear some of the friend's stories about Russia. And one of those stories was about a priest in Kyiv cutting a cross out of his palm and holding it up to the crowd. Yes. Like this during the Russian Revolution, which, you know, they didn't love priests, right? And so it's this remarkable detail about the Russian Revolution that's just tucked into this story that I never remembered. And I'm sure scholars have written all about it, but it's an extraordinary detail. And it's one that his father would have remembered because his father started hit and miss on this friend, right? So again, we're in a normal space still. It's a little weird. It's a little weird that he's gone across the hall to tell, but they're close enough that his father knows what he's talking about. You know, my friend in Petersburg, I am going to invite him after all to the wedding. Okay. All right. Fine. It is. It's slightly weird. Let's say it's not even that weird. None of this is that weird at this point in the story, I would argue.
Okay. Except,
except what?
The first time his father moves toward him and the dressing gown falls open and George thinks to himself, my father's still a giant.
Yeah.
That's weird.
But you think that's weird?
I think that's way weird.
Weird for a son to be thinking of a father that's deteriorating and now, but, you know, still his father. I can almost recall this, a similar kind of thing.
Well, I mean that it's weird, but it's a detail that I appreciate because of it just shows his father in a different way. I can imagine that he's just really seen his father dressed up for work, right? And not in this situation where he's in his robe or his nightgown or whatever.
At least not in a long time, apparently, because even
Yeah.
though they live in the same apartment, he hasn't really been in his father's room and
But
in a long time, and he's been involved in this very exciting courtship, so he's not around.
it's just weird to me, like that's like the first sort of that's the first thing we kind of see. But I guess he's trying to establish his father is older and he has deteriorated, but not really. I mean, there's still life in the guy, right?
Yeah, I mean, totally. And that's why, again, I think it's not that weird.
Except his mouth is toothless then, and there's another sort of thing about the passage of time here.
Yeah. I mean, obviously he hasn't been paying attention, but I mean, think of the like people who live with people who don't pay attention to them and all of a sudden
Oh
pay attention
yeah.
to them. You
Yes.
know what I mean? Like, I think that, like, again, I think, like, just because it's Kafka and that whole, don't get me started on Kafka-esque. You know what I mean? I mean, it does. I was going to say, just because it's Kafka doesn't mean it's Kafka-esque. It's not. There's nothing Kafka-esque about any of this at this point, I would argue.
Now, when he says, "Never mind about my friends," George says, "A thousand friends could never take the place of my father." Do you know what I think? You don't look after yourself enough. Old age is demanding its due. I can't do without you in the office. You know that as well as I. But if the business should ever start undermining your health, I'd shut up shop for good tomorrow. I'm not having that. And I feel like this reading, there's a trigger here or something, and he just goes on. You can have my bed, blah, blah, blah.
But
And
again, this is not weird.
no, it's not weird,
He's
but.
just saying you're getting old, but I'm really concerned about you, and let's he has forgotten about his dad up until this point. I remember when my brother went to college, he called me because he'd forgotten me for 4 years in high school. He just forgot I existed, even though we lived in the same house. So it kind of reminds me a little bit of like, oh, he's like, oh, right, you're still here, even though they work together and live together. But George is a bit, let's say, is a bit self-centered.
Yes. And he's about to make a apparently a major life transition himself. But the
George get
father's
married to the nice Frida, what's her name?
Yes.
Vermgold. Yeah,
But what happens next, this is what I picked up this time, that George says all these things. He cares about the dad. He wants to take care of him. And then this, George, his father said softly, not moving. George immediately knelt down beside his father. He looked into his father's weary face and into the huge pupils staring out at him from the corners of his father's eyes. You have no friend in Petersburg. You've always liked to have your little joke, even with me. How should you have a friend there of all places? I find that too much to believe. What do you make of just that small moment?
I mean, this is where the story goes from being relatively normal or even totally normal to bizarre. Okay, so if you go to the top of 51, that's when it first hits. What you read was the second time it hits. This is simply nature taking its course for one thing and for another. Mummy's death hit me much harder than it did you. But as long as we're on the subject of this letter, promise me one thing, George. Don't try to hook me. Can I read that again?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, because I think I hate to I'm messing up the structure, but I think that it's this line that is the one, and yours doubles down on this.
Yeah.
The story goes from fairly normal, even though there's weirdness in it, of course, but fairly normal, all of it, really.
It
A
is.
bit of a neurotic guy trying to decide whether or not he's going to invite this friend to the wedding, and it's all about how it reflects on him. But again, George is. Certainly, I can relate to George. George is the rest of us. That's how I see it. And he's having these machinations in his mind. Then he goes across the hall with the letter in his pocket, tells his father, "Hey, you remember my friend?" Right? And he's like, "Yeah, your friend, right? Your friend." And then the father says, "You changed your mind. You're going to invite him to the wedding." And then he says, "Yeah, I've changed my mind. I'm, if he's happy, if he's really my friend, he'll be happy that I'm happy." All right, again, this is fairly normal stuff, I'm going to say. George, his father said, putting his toothless mouth into a broad slit. Listen to me. Now things are getting intense. For what reason? I am not sure at all. Listen to me. You've come to me with this thing because you want to talk it over with me. That does you credit, no doubt about it. But it's no good. In fact, it's less than no good if you're not going to tell me the whole truth. I want to stir up things that have no place here. I don't want to stir up, sorry. It's no good. In fact, it's less than no good if you're not going to tell me the whole truth. I don't want to stir up things that have no place here. Since the death of your beloved mother, certain not very nice things have been happening. Maybe there's a time for them too, and maybe that time comes sooner than we expect. A great deal escapes me in the office, though perhaps not because it's kept from me. The last thing I'm trying to suggest is that things are being kept from me, but I haven't the strength anymore. My memory is beginning to go, and I have no longer have an eye for the little details. This is simply nature taking its course for one thing and for another. Again, this is all pretty normal. Mommy's death hit me much harder than it did you. But as long as we're on the subject of this letter, promise me one thing, George. Don't try to hoodwink me. It's a trifle. It's not worth bothering about. So don't try to hoodwink me. Do you really have this friend in Petersburg? It's like a bomb dropped in this story. I'm just going to say, you know, and I don't want to, I promise not to do this, you know, but I don't recall a moment in another story that sort of struck me in this way. It's almost like the story is sort of boring. I don't care about this guy. I don't care about his wedding. I don't care. I do care about his friend in Petersburg. I do. And that's, I think, something that is the strength of the story for me is that I sort of like feel for this guy in Petersburg, right? That he is summed up and thinks is kind of a loser. But when his father, what? Like, what, the friend in Petersburg, do you really have this friend in Petersburg? It's like, wait, what?
But what do you think that means? Because then we know what happens later about the father's perspective about the friend in Petersburg.
We can't go deeper. And this is where I think the mistakes of
right.
the scholars happen.
Oh, no. Okay.
This is batshit crazy. And there is nowhere to go other than to kind of like, wait, the father thinks there might not be a friend in Petersburg? There's no friend. So why invent this friend in Petersburg? Because you want to puff up yourself and tell stories about how great you are? Maybe. I suppose, but maybe we might invent friends that we can be better than. But again, it's pretty mundane. Like for some reason, I mean, this is why the story is as famous as it is, I suppose, and why it continues to endure, I would argue, is that it's utterly baffling. Yeah, Gregor Samsa turns into a monstrous vermin bug or whatever it is. You can understand why that would endure. But whether or not a businessman who's fallen on hard times in Russia exists or not, that's a great mystery. Like, what? I don't think you need to go any further than just kind of like, wait a second, what?
Yes, but the thing I noticed this time too is, so on 52, he says, "Think back for a moment, Father," heaving the old man out of his chair. And as he stood there in a really extremely weak condition, pulling off his dressing gown, there's all this thing with the gown and picking him up and putting him down and carrying him around, which I thought I wanted to talk about, but maybe I don't. But in that section, once again, he's in control of this narrative. You remember. And the stories about Kiev, and he had become involved in a disturbance and seen the priest up on a balcony, etc. You remember. So he doesn't pull the letter out. He pulls it out a little, puts it back in, and then he's in control of this narrative of the friend. Does the friend exist? Father says, no. Do you really have a friend? And then he says, you remember, and it's all coming from George. What about that?
It's always coming from George. And he once said somewhere about writing stories that they had to be all in one. And he did famously, as you already mentioned, he wrote this story in the course of one night. He started at 10 o'clock at night. He had a horrible, boring social experience with his brother-in-law's family, one of his sister's husbands. I don't might have been one of the ones that died in the Holocaust. Maybe they both did. I can't remember. But he had a bad he was a, he had a boring night. He sits down at his desk at 10 o'clock. He starts writing this odd piece about whether or not to invite again his friend from Petersburg. And but he says something to the effect of like that there's a totality of his attempt when he's writing fiction that. I mean, we talk about this, and it's like almost this ridiculous cliche about a short story about every word mattering, right? I'm not gonna say it here because I, I don't buy it, but I do feel like every section of the story, every paragraph, every sentence in this story truly does sort of is essential, so that even if we backtrack to the when the bomb drops, do you really have this friend in Petersburg? And then we meet up with what you were talking about, but in between. You really have this friend in Petersburg. George stood up in embarrassment. Never mind about, and this is how you've already mentioned. Never mind about my friends. 1,000 friends could never take the place of my father. He's not really tracking. The bomb apparently did not detonate for George. Do you really have this friend in Petersburg? He just kind of ignores that. He doesn't. He does not respond to that question. He actually says, "You know what? Actually, it doesn't matter about all any friend. 1,000 friends could never take the place of my father. You know what I think? You don't look good. You don't." Take care of yourself. Old age is demanding. And then he talks about this whole thing about how he's going to give him his room, which has more light. And he's going to, he even close the business if it, if his father would, become more vigorous and healthier. And so that's what happens. But then it's the father that as it brings back this question. Think back for, and so you have no friend in Petersburg. You have always liked to have your little joke, even with me. How should you have a friend there of all places? I find that too much to believe. And again, the father's like going back to this question of whether or not the friend exists. And then George does answer. Well, think back for a moment, father. George said, heaving the old man out of his chair as he stood there in extremely weak conditions, pulling off his dressing gown nearly 3 years ago. Now my friend came back here to see us. You don't particularly like him. And then it meets up with what you were talking about. And then again, we're still kind of like reading this, imagine reading the story for the first time, and you're like, all right, wait. So the father doesn't know if this kid exists, that this friend exists, and maybe the father's got dementia at this point. He doesn't remember. I mean, again, it could be normal still, even after the bomb drops in the story. I think it almost like Kafka's like not content with just making the story kind of like weirdly surprising. It actually becomes boring again. But the story's not over yet. So we're almost in this weird stasis. You know what I mean? Where we're like, and again, if you're imagining to just encountering this without all the baggage of his face and his on t-shirts and his name being a word in English and all these things, we're basically in a room with a son and a father, and the father is deteriorating. The son seems to be worried about him, but he also seems to rediscover that the father actually exists.
What do you make of this section on 53 then? Where he says, "Don't worry, you're well covered up." He's asking him, "Am I covered up?" He's covering him up with the quilt. "No, I'm not," his father shouted, slamming the answer down on the question, which I like. And he threw the quilt back with such force that for a moment it opened out completely in flight. He stood up in bed, one hand pressed lightly to the ceiling. "You wanted to cover me up, you scoundrel. I know you did, but I'm not covered up yet. If it's my last ounce of strength, it's enough for you, more than enough for you. I know your friend, all right." What is happening?
Well, I'm sure the academics say, you don't cover me up with dirt yet. I'm not dead, right? But it's the bedclothes, so I'm gonna stick with the bedclothes. I'm gonna stick with reading it literally. Am I covered up? Don't worry, you're well covered up. No, I'm not. You can't cover me up. You can't pretend that I'm not here or whatever. You can't cover up what I'm saying. And I'm gonna tell you again. You wanted to cover me up, you scoundrel? It's my last ounce of strength. It's enough for you. More than enough for you. I know your friend all right. A son after my own heart, he'd have been. So now, father has come roaring back. And what does he say? Not only does your friend exist, I know your friend exists. He's actually my friend. He's my friend. I've been in correspondence with him all these years. Me. I mean, this is just weird. You think I haven't wept for him? Like, it's like, you're like, what? Wait, you just said he didn't, what? And
Yes.
it's like, and yeah, you could make all these meanings, like he hasn't been, George hasn't been a good son, so then the father picks up the thread of the Russian guy because the Russian guy's not successful and needs a dad figure. Whatever, whatever, whatever. All I'm saying is the dad just said, wait, your friend doesn't exist. And now he's saying, your friend exists. And not only that, I weep for him.
The very next thing is to attack the idea of the future wife,
Yeah. And it gets pretty harsh here, doesn't it?
which makes me think about, oh, it's too weird. It's too weird. Like, does the father really know the friend? Is there a friend?
I have no idea.
We'll never
And
know.
nobody, and no one will ever know.
No one will know. And that's what makes the story great, I think. And the idea that the dad, if is the dad the friend? Is the dad this, sickly person who's not doing so well in
The
business?
dad's just getting old. The dad's just getting old. I think, he's Joe Biden. He's getting old. He's
And
getting old.
he's feeling like the friend, like the loser friend, and that George has to be so, gentle and kid gloved with the friend because he can't just come all out and say, hey, look at my life. I'm doing pretty great, because he feels bad for the friend. He seems to be in that same sort of position with the dad. Like, he's treating the dad that way too. Like, you're sick and you're old and sorry, and you're better than all 1,000 of my friends. And the dad's mad at the world, and he attacks his son. Like, there's so much resentment or something, and attacks the girl, attacks the future wife. It's so horrible, this part. It's so
Well,
hard.
maybe you should read it, because I think it'd be better if you read it than I read it. I mean, this is harsh stuff, and he's not
It's
even
terribly.
necessarily known for that. This is, I mean, this is a character talking, so we don't have to judge the
Yeah.
writer or anything, but here's what the dad says. What does he say?
He says, and now that you thought you'd get the better of him so much so that you could plant your bottom down on him and he wouldn't move, what does my high and mighty son do but get married? George looked up at this terrifying vision of his father, the friend in Petersburg whom his father suddenly knew so well, affected him as never before. He thought of him lost in the depths of Russia. He saw him at the door of his empty, looted shop against a background of smashed up shelving, ransacked stock, and bent gas brackets, barely able to stand. Why had he had to go so far away? Look at me, will you? His father shouted, and George almost distractedly ran over to the bed to take everything in, but came to a halt halfway there. Because she hauled up her skirts, his father began in a slimy falsetto. Because she hauled up her skirts like this, the filthy bitch. And by way of illustration, he lifted the hem of his nightshirt so high that the war wound on his thigh was exposed. Because she hauled up her skirts like this, and like this, and like this, like this, you had to have a go at her. And to make sure you can have your way with her undisturbed, you defile your mother's memory, betray your friend, and stick your father in bed where he can't budge. Well, can he budge or can't he?
I mean, there's so much there, and it is harsh, and it is, I mean, it is, the scene is incredibly rendered, I will say that. Because she hauled up her skirts, her father began in a slimy falsetto. The Muir translation of that says something about, he said it flutely, which is just, I just, it'd be interesting to know what he was trying to get at with this description of the voice here. Because I think translators throughout, I mean, there's probably 15 translations of this story, and I forget whose translator we have. We should give them a note or a shout out, because this is a British edition that I don't think is that all that common. Just that description: his father began a slight slimy falsetto because she hauled up her skirts like this, the filthy bitch. And by the way, and by way of illustration, he lifted and other. I should say that other translations do not say "filthy bitch." They say less harsh things, but I think this translator is like, I'm gonna do what Kafka was doing in the story, and I believe it. But again, I don't have the German, so I do not know. And by way of illustration, and this is just remarkable, and by way of illustration, he lifted the hem of his nightshirt so high that the war wound on his thigh was exposed. And then he keeps going in because she hauled her skirts. It's like, you know, and again, we don't know this woman. All we know is what he says about her. But, you know, the father obviously is feeling not very father-in-law-y to the new fiance. I also want to say one thing is the looted shop and the smashed up shelving kind of, you know, we can't forget that Kafka was Jewish and to me that sounds like a pogrom image, and then having the father's war wound so close to that, and again, you know, kind of almost like he's the father's as just as a character gets sort of this horrible lines, and so, and you know, as a reader we're like, oh wait, we don't like this, but then he's got this war wound to kind of, it tempers it, it sends it another way, and it also, you know, again makes you think of Jews fighting in World War One on behalf of, you know, in this case it would be, I don't know exactly, I guess it would be the Austria-Hungarian Empire, I would think, in World War One, that the suggestion is, because Kafka's from Prague, not from Germany. But anyway, it's just a remarkable doubling down, and this father kind of roaring, like, you can't put me down, like you put the friend in Petersburg down. And again, like, George didn't do anything with the friend in Petersburg. Friend in Petersburg moved and just didn't do that well in life. But there's something in this, just been on my mind all day. There's something about people who are good and who do all the right things on paper, that there may be a hint of something else going on with them. And I kind of think George is one of those people. He does all the right things on paper, but there's something. And again, George is not a unique person. He's a very average person. So many people are holding up their goodness and celebrating their goodness to themselves, which is what George does throughout the story. But I also think he's not a bad guy either. He does care for his father. He does. And I think he kind of cares for his friend. He just doesn't quite know how to handle it. If there's a friend, which I believe there is a friend. I don't believe the father's been corresponding with the friend. The father uses the story of the friend as a sort of whip. And it's just like, you're like, what the hell?
What about when he says, but the friend isn't betrayed after all, his father shouted, and a wagging forefinger corroborated this. I was his locum tenens here. I wonder what another translation would say, but that means like a placeholder.
Interesting. Okay. So what is it? I was his placeholder?
I was his substitute. I was like him.
Interesting. Interesting. Huh.
And then George says, play actor. George could not refrain from shouting. Realizing his mistake, he immediately, though too late, there was a glazed look in his eyes, bit his tongue so hard that he doubled up in pain. Of course I've been play acting. Oh my God.
What other consolation was left your old widowed father? Tell me, and for the space of your answer, be my living son still. What else was left to me in my little back room, persecuted by my disloyal staff? I mean, it sounds like King Lear here. It's just like, you know, like an old man going unhinged. But again, unlike King Lear, we know who's on what side. And this one, we're not sure about George. And that's what makes the story, I think, so remarkable, is that to the very end, certainly to the very end, we don't know about George. We don't know whose side to be on. We don't know. And the father is just this incredible force of nature in his dialogue. Tell me, for the space of your answer, be my living son still. What else was left to me in my little back room, persecuted by my disloyal staff, an old man to the marrow of my bones, and my son went about rejoicing, clinching deals that I had set up, giddying himself with pleasure, and departing from his father's presence with the opaque face of a man of honor. Do you think I didn't love you, having fathered you? I mean, it's like, now he's going to lean forward, George thought. if only he'd fallen smashed to pieces again. It's like, again, like, wait a second. That was, you use your father who fought, loved you, but now George is on a different track. If only he'd fallen smashed to pieces, the words went hissing through his head. His father leaned forward but did not fall. Since George did not approach as he had expected, he straightened up again. And this is just incredible. And I read this a bunch of times today because I couldn't even follow it because I didn't know who was talking. His father leaned forward but did not fall. Since George did not approach as he'd expected, he straightened up. Wait, stay where you are. So it's like, if it's like when you tell somebody to do what they haven't done, don't help me, but they haven't raised a finger because you're almost calling attention to the fact that they haven't. Don't help me. I don't need your help. But you haven't made a move to help. Stay where you are. I don't need you. You think you still have the strength to come over here and are just holding back because you want to? Well, don't delude yourself. I'm still the stronger by far. On my own, I might have had to stand down, but mother left me her strength. I'm in business with your friend in a big way. I've got your customer right here in my pocket. What? I have no idea what that means. He's even got pockets in his nightshirts, George said to himself, thinking that he could make himself look ridiculous in the eyes of the whole world by this remark. That really, that's an incredible moment of him like wondering, like, why did I just think that? And if anyone knew I thought that, I mean, George is very conscious of how he appears to the world, right? Again, like everybody else, you know, I don't think George is a villain. I don't think the father's a villain. I think these are two incredibly ordinary father and sons.
I do too. That's why when you say who's right, who's wrong, who's telling the truth, who's lying, neither and both.
Yeah. Yeah. Which again makes it a story that is bound to confound and you don't need some academic kind of coming on from high and telling us what it means. Because I swear to God, no one knows what it means except that you know what it means in your bones because you know what it's like to have a parent. So you don't need anyone else to tell you, even though the story's baffling, that what's happening on the page is enough. And if you just stick with that, the beauties of the story, I think, are just there, even though it's unsatisfying because you don't have any idea what he's trying to say. And that's because he isn't trying to say anything. He's just trying to live with his dad here. But then what happens? We go on, right? We're getting to the end.
Yeah, I think my problem with the story is the end.
All right.
Yeah. The rest of it that's so confounding is where I kind of live with the story, is how confounding these relationships are, and nobody's right and nobody's wrong, and it's all so terrible, and it remains terrible, and there's no solution, and you just have to live with it and through it. So the ending is what sort of throws me off with the story in 2024.
And so at the bottom of 55, going into the end, father's still going on about it. You made me laugh today. Come and ask whether you should write to your friend about your engagement. He knows everything, stupid. He knows everything. So it's like, again, you're like, wait. The friend knows all about the engagement? Yeah, because the father's been telling him about the hussy that you've been going around with. I wrote to him myself because you forgot to take my writing things away. Like, what? They're still in business together. Of course he has writing things. Like, it's just like the father's, I mean, you could make a diagnosis that he's having some kind of like psychic break or dementia or whatever it is. But that's why he hasn't been here for years, he says about the friend. He knows everything 100 times better than you do yourself. He screws your letters. This is a weird translation here, because I think it's about he's just crumples, really. He screws your letters up unread in his left hand while holding up my letters to read in his right. He waved about his arm enthusiastically above his head. He knows everything 1,000 times better, he yelled. So it's what I mean by like the totality is like, you can't talk about the story without almost reading every word. That's what Kafka meant, I think, but he even said something to the effect of like wanting novels to be like that too. You know, they could be as if they could be written in one sitting. Mm-hmm. Like that's what he wanted. And that's why the story, I think, meant so much to him, is because it was an example of something that did get written in one sitting. And he just, you know, like, and there's so much out there about the story, but basically he just followed along. He didn't really know what it was saying. And I think to this day, he doesn't know what it's saying, except that it's like totally seeable. And I think totally believable, which is why it's so horrifying. It's a comic horror story. For years, I've been waiting for you to come along with that question. Do you think I care about anything else? Do you think I even read the papers? And we, you know, we had that line about the paper. He's reading this huge daily paper. He's not reading the papers. It's an old paper, an old newspaper with a name George did not even begin to recognize. He's not reading the news. All he cares about is this friend from Petersburg. The time it's taking you to grow up. Your mother had to die. She will not see the joyful day. The joyful day, I guess the wedding, right?
Yeah.
But I can't imagine the father thinks it's going to be so joyful, but I guess he's becoming a mother there. Your friend going to rack and ruin in Russia. He looked as if he was on his last legs 3 years ago. And you can see for yourself the state I'm in. You've got eyes, haven't you? So amid all this ruin, and you, as you already pointed out, the father has become, in his mind, the friend in Petersburg. I mean, that is the way to, I mean, as an interpretation of the story, I think that's beautiful. You know, because I think it's happening in real time on the page. When Kafka inhabited the character of the father, the father went there, you know, but I don't think like Kafka injected it and thought ahead of time, oh, I'm going to make the father kind of feel as bad about himself as the friend in Petersburg. I just think it sort of just came or something, you know. So you've been trying to catch me out, cried George. Sympathetically, his father observed. He wanted to say that before, probably. Now it's completely out of place. And you're like, wait, that's almost like metafiction there. You know what I mean? Like you wanted to say that before in the story. Now you're saying it's a little late. And in a louder voice. So now you know what else there was apart from you. Up to now, you only knew about yourself. You were an innocent child to tell the truth. Though to tell the truth, you were the devil incarnate. Therefore, no, I hereby sentence you to death by drowning. Do you want to read the last paragraph?
No, I want you to read it.
Well, what, I guess before we read it, like what troubles you? I mean, aside from everything.
What troubles me about the ending?
Yeah. Like, are you bothered by it, like, as a fiction, as a piece of writing, or are you bothered by it because of what happens? Because, or are you bothered by it doesn't fit? Which I think is arguable, by the way.
You think it's arguable that it doesn't fit?
Absolutely. The story could end. Yeah, absolutely. Just because it's like Kafka doesn't mean it's written in some kind of stone.
It made me think about Paul's case again this time. You know, the story Paul's case. So in that story, the boy would rather die than go back home and face the consequences of what he's done. And so he throws himself in front of a train and in the very last moment regrets it. We see in the story in 1 second. That he imagines himself alive and that it would have been okay.
Maybe we need to do that story.
Yeah, that's a good story.
Let's do that.
I'd like to hear about how you think it fits, but
I don't think it fits at all. I mean, I don't think it fits at all. I just think it is what it is.
Okay, it is what it is, and yeah, and it makes me think about the story a little more deeply and realize that George has been on shaky ground from the beginning. Like, this is not a story about George controlling the narrative and having his life together. This is a story about George being quite the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the ending is what makes that so clear.
Right. And that, I think, is what makes the ending so remarkable.
Yeah.
And you know, and you read it again and you realize, you know, all the clues, and all the clues are every single line in the story. You know what I mean? All is, you know, and I was, had been hesitating to say this because it's going to sound academic, but, and I don't know if we've ever done it, but I think we should. I think we should do Bartleby. There's a sense, me, I get the same sense of someone trapped in a story. In that case, it's the lawyer telling the story. He completely, you know, we're sitting there reading the story. I'm like, wait a second, dude, can't you see what's in front of you? No, because he's trapped in his life. And this is the real deal. George is trapped in his life. And he's not admitting, he's not being honest about it. But again, who is? Who is honest about it? And, you know, when I think about this story and I think about the ending of it, I think that Kafka himself, and this is where I, doing what I exactly didn't want to do. You know, where Kafka himself, who had a lot of comedy in his life and a lot of laughter, much more than we think of, much more, obviously struggled you know, with some demons, you
Yes.
know. But he, you know, Kafka did not commit suicide. I think that's something that it should be studied. The last thing Kafka wanted to do was die. In this story, George does commit suicide based on the judgment that his father is just, is basically his father has sentenced him to death. As you could argue that it's an execution, really, and not a suicide. But I don't even know what I'm saying. All I'm saying is, it's like it makes me think of the writer and the sense of hope that he actually had, even though he was creating these this dark work.
But also, I'm just going to say real quick, it also reminds me of the Gina Berielt story. Who is it can tell me who I am?
That librarian story?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just when you mentioned Bartleby, it reminded me.
All right. We should do that story because I always forget it.
Yeah, that's a great, that's a gorgeous story.
Yeah. I think, but I want to read it again. But, you know, I think here it's like, I mean, every, you know, people have been reading this story for, you know, what, 80 years or some more, you know, and obviously confounded by the ending. And I think, you know, again, I think it's all in the words. So George felt himself thrust from the room, felt himself thrust, like external. The thud which his father fell on the bed behind him still echoing in his ears. On the stairs, which he took at a rush as if descending an inclined plane, he surprised his cleaning lady, who was going to tidy the flat after the night. She does that a line. Jesus, she cried, hiding her face in her apron. But he had already gone. Now in real life, or at least according to what I've read, when he finished the story about, you know, in the morning, the maid had just arrived and he spoke to her and he said to her that he'd been up all night working and he was celebrating. So it's totally the opposite. Like, this is George running by and her saying, Jesus, what was that about? Out the door, he shot, his momentum carrying him across the road to the water's edge. He clutched the railing as a hungry man will clutch at food. He vaulted over it. Again, this is like positive language. He vaulted over it, expert gymnast. And this is, again, what you forget, and I certainly do, unless I'm looking at the paragraph itself. He vaulted over it, an expert gymnast that he had been in his boyhood days, much to his parents' pride. And that in itself could end right there, not to edit Kafka. But still holding on with a weakening grip, he glimpsed a bus through the bars. And it was also great. Knew it would easily cover the noise of his fall, called softly, dear parents, I did love you always, and let himself drop. Crossing the bridge at that moment was a simply endless stream of traffic. Now, again, I'm going to defy anybody to tell me, like, why he commits suicide based on his father sentencing him to death by drowning because of the friend that he's, it isn't abstract either. You know what I mean? It's not like you know what I mean? This is like, quote unquote, realism. I mean, maybe we've ruined the story a little bit for those who haven't read it. And I hope that's not the case, because I think even if you do get all the way to this, the story is so kind of so beyond what we can say about it. And I think we can say that about, I think we say it about most stories, but this one truly is beyond, like, even sort of its description in terms of the way it makes you feel at the end as a conundrum.
And then I started to think that, you know, this idea that George was just the unhinged one the whole time. And there was, you know, he's choreographing this whole thing about the fiance wanting to write letters to the friend in Petersburg. Just like, that really happened? Where is she? Who is
and again,
she?
It's like, it's, we don't, it doesn't,
and
you
it
know,
doesn't,
it's like Bartleby. It's like, it does it, did that really happen? We only have the narrator's word for this.
That's right.
And it's the third person story, so I guess we can assume that it's a straight up thing. You know, I just know what I know, and I know that if I feel him going over that railing like the gymnast he was when he was a kid, and if I'm horrified by it, then the story has gone somewhere where
not,
gone a lot of places.
You know what? I love the story more now. Now, but the thing about, here it is. He vaulted over an expert gymnast that he had been in his boyhood days, much to his parents' pride. The gut punch of that line for me is, I think George feels like a huge disappointment to his father as an adult, and maybe was to his mother. But in childhood, right, before he ruined everything, before he perceives that he ruined everything, you know, there's this sort of...
just apparently just having a fairly normal life working for his father.
Yeah.
But anyone, even if you have a fairly normal life, and even if you do exactly what your parents want you to do, you're still going to somehow screw it up.
Yeah. And you're going to hearken back to your days as a young boy gymnast as the glory days and the last time you did anything right.
Maybe. You know, you could call it a comedy until, I mean, you know, people throwing themselves into rivers is not comedy. It's just not. And he knew that. But I do think he got a huge kick out of the story. And the fact that it gave him such joy, and that it becomes part of sort of his legend, which is that, you know, I mean, how do we know that he was up all night writing the story? Because he was showing off about it when he went to, you know, read to his friends at the Café Louvre in Prague, mm-hmm. where he would read out loud, and everyone would howl. You know, George is not an artist. George is a businessman. But the weird thing about Kafka is Kafka was also a businessman. So he knew the deadeningness of what some people who work in this field might feel. And, you know, but he was writing about it all night and then going to work the next morning at the insurance company. You know, that's why I think he's such a fascinating figure biographically.
Yeah.
You know, and why this story might, you know, how be somehow used to interpret. But I mean, to me, if I was to interpret Kafka through the story, I was like, this is how he got his kicks. And that's what I took away with doing the research for the show, which I pretend I don't do, but I do. I do. And here I was like delighted by his delight. And that's what I gathered that he had from this story. And one of the books I have about Kafka is by an Italian writer named Pietro Citati. And it's not a great book, but it tries to go into Kafka's head. As many, there's so many, you know, so many. And but I do think that that his description of his account of the night he wrote the judgment, again, was this. Kafka was 29 years old, and this was like the beginning, you know, kind of what he considered the beginning of his writing career in terms of his ability. I mean, he'd already written, I think, America, and struggled with it, or was still, you know, he never finished the novels. Mm-hmm. The beautiful line of Borges where he says that, you know, there's a reason Kafka didn't finish the novels. He wanted to write unfinished novels because there wasn't any way to possibly finish them. But in terms of a story, I think there he did finish, and the judgment's finished. And whether we like it or not, George jumps in the river. Why? I can't tell you. Or maybe, you know, I'll take a stab to honor his father's judgment. Therefore, no, I hereby sentence you to death by drown. All right, Dad. You do still have power. You're not a feeble old man. You can make a pronouncement. Look, watch me.
Franz Kafka is the author of The Judgment. This has been The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.